quem nada. Sai da minha frente que eu quero passar. Pois o samba está animado. O que eu quero é samba. Este samba que é misto de maracatu. É samba de preto veio. Samba de preto do. Mas que nada. Um samba como este é tão legal. Você ainda vai querer que eu chegue no final. Que eu quero passar, pois o samba já animado. O que eu quero é samba.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Thursday edition. Today's date is December 28th, 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. And of course, I told you by week's end we would be doing at least another investigative file, and I'm so pleased that we're going to be doing something with my good friend Christopher Bolin today. We've been looking into a lot of the subject matter that is going to forward this investigation, more principally looking at who in 9/11 was principal in making some of the decisions and how they're connected to the Zionist movement and more specifically how they connect to the Israelis. Now, I've been looking more and more at Carol Valentine's work lately, and she was able back in 2001 and 2 to give some real good direction to some of the research that we've been doing lately. And this she said that much of the control of the Zionist movement is right in America. Now, when Eric put on the site that the Jewish American government is not necessarily the ones that we need to be angry at, but people within the government, elements, rogue elements. And I have to agree with that, because I have to say that most of the American government is compartmentalized, and many of them don't know what these Zionists are doing in their name. And the fact of the matter is, today's discussion is going to be about Cleveland in some way, and about some of the main centers in America that have these powerful connections. But more than that, we're going to talk about the Likud's criminal gang, an article that was written by Christopher Bolin, as well as the Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert's connection to these people. So we're going to get right to it. Are you with me, Christopher?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. It's
Hello,
a wonderful
Daryl.
Connection, too. It's great to have you with me.
Good to be with you.
Well, you know, this first let's talk about this Likud party. And, I mean, Likudniks have become more and more virulent and more criminal over the last 15 years or so. Under the control of first of all, Netanyahu was in there, I guess, 11, 12 years ago. He ramped up the criminality against the Palestinians. And then, of course, he put in his henchman friend, Sharon. And now we're back to this other criminal who used to be the mayor of Jerusalem.
But Olmert,
yeah. Now, hasn't Olmert actually been charged in some investigations for being a mafia don almost?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing is that the Likudniks haven't become any more criminal than they always were. They've just come out of the closet. The Likud party is the evolution of the Irgun, and that's the Irgun was the militia headed by Vladimir Jabotinsky of Odessa, created, I think, in 1937, and it was the new Zionist organization, or the NZO's militia. And the NZO broke away from the traditional Zionists, or the Zionists in power at the time, because the NZO, headed by Jabotinsky, believed in using terrorism and brute force to achieve their ends. They were the non-political ones. They were the terrorist, the wing. And what happened is that the Irgun was created along with Betar, the youth military movement, also headed by Jabotinsky. Now, Vladimir Jabotinsky is the godfather of this whole thing. He's from Odessa, and he was the person who believed that there could be no compromise with the Palestinians, that basically the Jews have the right to all of the land of what they call Eretz Israel, which extends from, in their view, from the Nile River of Egypt to the Euphrates River of Iraq.
Now, did they write, Christopher, what their justification was? Because what we've been able to discover is, by and large, these people are convert Jews in the 7th century. So what were they using as a justification for having a right to take that land, other than just saying it's ours?
Well, that's very good that you talk about this ancestry. These people who formed the Likud, who formed at the time the Irgun, basically come from the Pale of Settlement, and they come from specific areas. Jabotinsky comes from Odessa. Some of them come from Odessa, which is in Ukraine today. But many of them come from the area of Poland and Belorussia, the area around Vilnius, Kaunas, Grodno, and these villages in what is today Belorussia.
And
that's
Lubavitch.
The northern part of the Pale. They come from there. Yeah.
The city of Lubavitch actually is their spiritual home.
Yeah, it's these shuttles, these Jewish communities that lived, as Jewish communities. And these people saw Zionism coming out in the 1800s as their way to create a state for themselves, as a nation for themselves. And they were very quick to pick up on the reconstituted Hebrew language, which was, which is what they call Ivrit. It's not really Hebrew. It's reconstituted form of Hebrew, taken from biblical Hebrew and their Slavic language, what they spoke,
which was Yiddish, right?
Well, Yiddish with it's got elements of Yiddish in it, and it's got a lot of characteristics of Slavic, of the Slavic language, of the Sorbian language, of the West Slavic languages. There's a very good book about the Ashkenazi Slavic people in search of a Jewish identity. By I think his name is Paul Wexler at Tel Aviv University. It's a very good book for people who are interested in the linguistics of modern-day Hebrew, Yiddish, and who the Ashkenazis really are linguistically.
Well,
and linguistically, it's very important. I mean, people don't understand much about linguistics, but it's very important because you can wrap yourself up and call you anything you want, but you can't hide your tongue, your language, and your culture.
That's right. Well, the interesting thing is that they chose the Holy Land as their base for this new state. Now, mm-hmm. were there forces that were directing them to do that, or did they do it from some biblical reference, or did they do it from some Babylonian reference, what was their impetus for having that as a selected area? Because basically, the area that they chose was not necessarily the land of the Israelis. That region had an Israeli element, but it was Sephardi and it was Semitic.
Right. Well, when you ask these questions, the real people in the architectural level have to be the Rothschilds. I mean, the Balfour Declaration of, was it 1914, the Balfour Declaration, where the British government said that they viewed the formation of a Jewish state with favor, mm-hmm. Not interfering with the indigenous population. The Balfour Declaration was written as a letter to Lord Balfour. I mean, to Lord Rothschild. Excuse me, Lord
right.
Rothschild, who was the leader of the Jewish community of England, of Britain, this letter was addressed to him, and that's very important because here you're getting the members of Parliament and the Prime Minister of Britain writing a letter to Lord Rothschild. I don't know if his name was Nathan or what his name was, but he's Lord Rothschild, the one in Britain, and he was receiving this promise from the government that they would view the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine with favor. And that's very important because, of course, at the time, this is post-World War or the World War One time or just shortly after World War One, the British, were the occupying power, were the controllers, they had the mandate for Palestine. So for them to say they view the creation of the Jewish state with favor, and they're writing this letter to Mr. Rothschild, and then his brother in London, in Paris, gave something like 70 million gold coins to create this, to buy land and to create this state.
And didn't they begin to pay for the travel of these original groups that were, because the Jews that were originally there and they began to build these little kibbutz centers.
Yeah.
Were actually financed, and they were equipped, and they were given farm equipment, and they were given irrigation equipment by this Rothschild group to go and set themselves up. And originally, they didn't really fight very much with the natives because there was enough land that was not in dispute at the time. So the real battling started in the 20s, didn't it?
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point, is that this traditional Zionist, like these Rothschild Zionists, thought that they could create the Jewish state, like the Balfour Declaration said, without compromising the welfare of the indigenous communities. So they bought land, and they settled land. They created these kibbutzes and these moshavs, these collective farms. And this is where the real falling out occurred, because that community had the Haganah. They had their Jewish defense, the Palmach and the Haganah. And then there was the new Zionist organization, which was headed by Jabotinsky, who said, no, you're not going to get Palestine this way. You've got to use brute force. You've got to kill the Palestinians. You have to drive them off the land. And it's very important to understand that the executive secretary for Vladimir Jabotinsky was in New York at the time, and that was Mr. Netanyahu's father. That was Ben-Zion Netanyahu. And so Ben-Zion is probably not his real name. Ben-Zion, of course, means son of Zion. And he was the executive secretary for Jabotinsky, and he took out full-page ads in the New York Times where they said, the solution for the Jewish problem is that the Jews get Palestine and the Arabs get Iraq. The Palestinians get Iraq. And that's very important to understand. There's no discussion of the countries in between, like Syria and Jordan and Lebanon. Because in the Jabotinsky plan, the new Zionist organization, the Likud, if you will, it means that all of that land is in fact Eretz Israel. And the land of Israel. That's what Eretz Israel means, the land of Israel. And that the Palestinians, the Arabs, are going to go to Iraq. And what we're seeing today is we're seeing the chaos in which they intend to make this plan a reality.
Well, now when I take a thought about some of these things, now I understand back in the 20s, they actually tried to float an idea that 6 million Jews were murdered in some pogroms that had happened, and the 6 million figure was actually placed in a Reader's Digest article. And it was soundly argued against by intellectuals and researchers, and it, of course that was the first introduction of that 6 million number. Now they resurrected that later, but what was the significance, or what is the significance within their structure of 6 million?
Oh, I don't know Hebrew numerology that well, but as you said, it was brought up. It was bandied about after World War I.
Yep.
As being the true number of Israelis or Jews who had been killed in the First World War. And then, as you said, it was brought up again a second time. It's probably got some significance, in Jewish numerology, because in the Jewish language, every letter has a number associated with it. So if you 6 million in Hebrew is something, but every year has a name associated with it, because the Hebrew numbers, as I said, correspond with.
Well, I know that they have their Tanyas, and the Lubavitchers have a Tanya for people, which is numerically decided, and the dates and stuff are very very stuck to those Tanyas, and they believe them actually. But mm-hmm. let's get involved here with this present situation with Olmert,
right,
and what he inherited from Sharon, and was Sharon in fact poisoned off or killed off or. Or was mm-hmm. was he just so fat he just croaked himself? I mean, the guy was slovenly in so many ways. He was a glutton.
Yeah.
His son is an evil looking glutton, is what he looks like.
Yeah. The Sharons are ruthless Jabotinsky Likudniks. That's for sure. I wouldn't doubt that for a minute. That's happened commonly in Israeli history, that leaders have been disposed of. You look at what happened to Yitzhak Rabin. And if you look at the one guy who outlived them all, it's Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres has been a member of the Israeli government since 1959 without interruption. That's very important. I mean, even now, they have the so-called Kadima party, a centrist party. And he is the assistant prime minister.
And he's a Jabotinsky Ashkenazi as well, isn't he?
He's a Jabotinsky. Yeah, he's from Poland. He's from Belarusia, his country, where he was born.
What's his name? Shem something?
Shimon Peretz.
His name is Shem Pinkel or something. Shem. He changed his name to Peretz.
Yeah, his real last name isn't Peretz, it's like Peretz or something like that. But he's the father of the Israeli nuclear bomb. That's important to understand. He has been the key broker. He's been the key person involved in the creation of the Israeli nuclear arsenal.
Yeah.
That's why he is still at the top. And he's like 85 years old now, but he's still in the Israeli government. And that's the guy that's really key to a lot of this. Ehud Olmert is the new prime minister, who's just trying to be the tough guy. But he also comes from a Likud family. His father was a Jabotinsky supporter. His father was in the Irgun. And Jabotinsky, Ehud Olmert, is tainted with a criminal charges from back in the 1980s. I think it was 1988, when he was the treasurer of the Likud party. There was a lot of money coming from the United States, money coming from Cleveland, from Chicago, from New York, and Hollywood, going into the coffers of the Likud party. Money like from Irving Moskowitz. And people like that. People who belong to the elite criminal network of Zionists in this country were sending money. And in order to hide this money, they were going through all kinds of financial schemes. And Olmert was the treasurer of the party. And his assistant treasurer, his co-treasurer, was a man named Menachem Atzmon. And Menachem Atzmon was convicted of these crimes, along with a couple other people from the Likud party. But Ehud Olmert, who was then mayor of Jerusalem, I think he was mayor of Jerusalem at the time, or he was just a high-ranking Likud guy. He became mayor of Jerusalem in 1993, I think. But he was given a deference by the prosecutor. And although he was indicted and charged, he was acquitted. And yet,
and it wasn't under his auspices that a lot of the houses in East Jerusalem were expropriated from the Arabs.
Yes, because he was the mayor of Jerusalem for 10 years, and during that time, the enlargement of Jerusalem went on. I mean, Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, is a very, very small town. Actually, it's a walled city with a few areas around it. But Jerusalem itself is a very small city. But under the Likud party, they've expanded the confines of Jerusalem, the environ, to going all the way up to Ramallah in the north and down to Bethlehem in the south and to Jericho in the east. So they've created this very enlarged city of Jerusalem, which they, of course, always say is the indivisible capital of Israel. So what they're saying is indivisible capital of Israel is now become like half of the West Bank. I mean, it's a huge piece of land. And it's just robbery. It's theft. You know, the Israeli occupation of Jerusalem is illegal. It's not recognized by any country in the world except maybe the Marshall Islands or something like that, Fiji. Even the United States does not recognize the Israeli occupation of Jerusalem. And that's very important because when the President Ahmadinejad of Iran, when he spoke about the destruction of Israel, he didn't say that. He said that the occupying regime that is occupying Jerusalem has to be destroyed. Now, he's only saying what the United Nations resolutions also say. The UN resolutions pertaining to Jerusalem all say that the occupation of Jerusalem is wrong, illegal, and has to be reversed.
Yeah.
So, you see, they're putting words in his mouth when they say to destroy Israel.
Well, let's go into this Likud's connection to the United States, because I know that you mentioned it already. Much of their funding comes from the U.S. There was an organization that funnels huge sums of money to these people, and you sent me the link to it. You sent it to Eric, and I got my hands on it here. It absolutely floored me because when I saw that this organization, it's called the Jewish Agency for Israel.
Yeah, and the Jewish Agency.
It's
an old establishment. It was from before the time even of the creation of the State of Israel. The Jewish Agency existed, and it is the Zionist agency, basically the executive branch that is the Zionist organization. You know, like it worked with the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish Agency worked together, and they collected the money that came from Europe and the United States and South Africa, whatnot, for the creation of the State of Israel. Today, the Jewish Agency is headquartered in Jerusalem, and it receives huge amounts of money from what these organizations, what are basically Zionist organizations, which are branches of the United Jewish Appeal.
Well, it's a third of a billion dollars that they've declared.
Well, they have billions. They have billions of dollars. Now, the thing is that they collect the money. There's a United Jewish Appeal, for example, in Aspen Valley, Colorado. There's a United Jewish Appeal in Atlanta. There's one in Chicago, in Hollywood. Every major city in the United States that's got a few Jews in it has a UJA chapter or a United Jewish Appeal. They collect money. They extort money. They get money, you know, by hook or by crook, and they send it to the Jewish agency in Jerusalem. Now, that's very important because that's the money that they use for their Zionist schemes and what they're going to do in Israel. And it's important to note that, like, Dan Senor, who was the senior advisor to Jared Bremer,
yeah,
in the first year and a half of the occupation,
mm-hmm,
his father was an executive in Jerusalem for the Jewish agency. His father's name was James Senor. And he's originally from Utica, New York. But he went over there. He went over there to Jerusalem in the 70s, and he was the he worked in the Jewish agency in Jerusalem. And then his son who grew up in Toronto and maybe in New York a little bit, Dan Senior, went to Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and then came back to the States and got an MBA at Harvard. And went right to work with the Carlyle Group. And as soon as this occupation began, he was made the senior advisor to Jerry Bremer. And so
there's a United Nations connection to the Israelis. Because it seems to me that why wouldn't the United Nations make a stink about the fact that the Iranians don't even have a bomb, nor will they have one for several years, but the Israelis for 30 years have been sitting on a bomb-making factory, and the United Nations says zero, says nothing. That
right.
means that these people have been quieted by somebody within that organization. And,
absolutely.
I would love to find out what Dennis Halliday has to say about it, because it seems pretty clear to me that these people have bought and paid for the United Nations as well.
Of course. And it's the Rockefellers. The Rockefellers have a huge control over the United Nations, and they, like you said, the head of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the Egyptian fella, about
a day,
he went over there to Israel last year and had some lunch and cookies with the prime minister and the government of Israel and said nothing, and basically got his marching orders not to say anything about the Israeli nuclear program.
Well, now, Ehud Olmert just spilled the cookies over there in Germany, didn't he?
Right. Well, Ehud Olmert, yeah, he was on German TV, and he talked about that Iran is not like these countries that have the nuclear weapon, and he listed, France, the United States, and Israel. And he, tacitly acknowledged that Israel has a nuclear weapon.
Mm.
Now, what's interesting about this is that, we were talking about his crimes in Israel in 1988.
Yep.
And the person that he was the co-treasurer, there were two treasurers of the Likud party, Ehud Olmert and Menachem Atzmon. Menachem Atzmon was convicted, found guilty in an Israeli court of financial crimes, raising money for the Likud party. This is the Likud party of Menachem Begin, of Ariel Sharon, of all of these really, really hideous,
yeah,
hideous, racist criminals who have, invaded Lebanon on several occasions and brought wars to the Middle East and great disaster for the Palestinian people. Well, Menachem Atzmon also happened to be the person who was in charge of security at Boston Logan Airport and Newark Airport on 9/11.
Huntley Incorporated, Huntley International?
Huntley USA, yes. His company is called ICTS.
Yep.
It stands for International Consultants on Targeted Security. And it's based in Holland now. And Menachem Atzmon and a fellow named Harel own this company.
And don't they have ties directly to Herzliya?
Very much, very much so. Harel was a former head of the Mossad or deputy head of Mossad. And this company is, I noticed this for years, how when I used to fly around Europe and the Middle East, the way Israeli practices of passenger screening began to be employed in German airports and Dutch airports and French airports and wherever you'd go. And then you'd ask these fellows, boy, you sound just like the Israelis. You'd say, yeah, we work for them or we are Israeli. and say, son of a gun, you know, you're getting on a plane, a KLM flight, or you're getting on a Lufthansa flight, and you're being screened by Israelis. And this is what happened in this country as well. And on 9/11, all the passengers that went through Boston Logan Airport and the airport at Newark, which is one of the flights originated, Flight 93 originated there, all of these passengers were screened by Huntley USA, which was completely a wholly owned subsidiary of ICTS, owned by these two Israeli Mossad guys.
Well, now we know.
And close friends, of course, and co-defendants with Ehud Olmert. So, I mean, is this a coincidence?
Well, no, it's not. And, Christopher, but, you know, we also know there's some questions about the passenger list that day. And the only way that they could ever make it seem like there were actually people getting on those planes or people that they wanted to be on those planes, I mean, they had to finagle the boarding stuff. I mean, there was no Arabs on the flight manifest.
Of course not. There were no Arabs on the flight manifest because there were probably no Arabs on the flight. But in order to create the evidence that so-and-so went through or something, you see, these companies, these foreign-owned passenger security companies, primarily in this case we're talking about Huntley USA, but there were three companies involved that day. All three are foreign-owned. And all three have been given an exoneration by the U.S. Congress in 2002, I think it was, that they will not be investigated and they will not be called into a court to account. I mean, if we ever get a 9/11 case in court. But I mean, in the case, for example, Ellen Mariani, and her husband was on flight 175. Now, if she's able to get her case to be heard in a court and there's discovery, she wants to know what exactly happened at Boston's Logan Airport that morning. Who got on the plane? Who didn't get on the plane? Who was doing security? These are questions the American people have a right to know. And Congress cannot exonerate an Israeli-owned company simply because of their sweetheart deals and their lobbying, you know, lobbying money that they're getting from this Israeli lobby.
Well, on a side note, I understand from other investigations I've looked into that these same people are using this network they've got in Stoppel Airport and in Rhein-Main and different places around Europe to funnel white slavery, to funnel drugs and ecstasy. Heroin out of Afghanistan comes through on these flights. It ships into different points in the United States and into Europe. Of course, Holland, Stoppel Airport being one of the main hubs for it all.
Right.
And so basically they get a free pass on getting whatever and whoever they want to be sent internationally with different shipments because they're doing the security.
No, that's a good point. And you see, that's the thing is that the when you look at the Zionist network in the United States that supports this state of Israel, and particularly the Zionist groups that support the Likud, you find that it's not from the little contributions made in the local synagogues. It comes from very, very big, wealthy Zionists who have made their money in very dubious ways. Many of them are crime related. For example, a lot of this goes back to Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland, Ohio isn't the biggest, the first town that comes to mind, you know, when you talk about Jewish power in this country, but it is a very significant power and has been for a very long time. It was in the 1900s, early 1900s, it was the center of organized crime in the United States. And that organized crime was primarily Jewish.
And why? It was because they were bringing alcohol in over the border and shipping half of it to Chicago and half of it to New York.
Right. And that's what happened in Detroit and Cleveland, these towns along the border of Canada. They were involved in this smuggling operations and things like that. And it's, you know, they became very big. There was very big Jewish criminals came out of Boston, out of Cleveland. And what we find is that a lot of these big Zionists, who are implicated in 9/11 in my investigation, come from Cleveland, like
now,
the Ratner family. The Ratner family.
Who are they?
The Ratner family comes first to mind because the Ratners are all over 9/11. You have the guy that ran the mayor of Cleveland worked for the Ratners. The Ratners have a huge company called Forest City Enterprises in Cleveland, Ohio, and they, for example, develop properties and run properties for the United States Navy. They manage and they develop control. Great Lakes Naval Base and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, and Pearl Harbor and other naval bases are run by this company. And it's called Forest City Enterprises and it's headed by the Ratner family. And And this Ratner family also has relatives who are sons and daughters of billionaires who are involved in, for example, the defense of the Guantanamo prisoners. I think his name is Michael Ratner. He's a sort of a leftist Jew in New York, and he has the, I think it's called the Center for Constitutional Freedom or some organization, some constitutional type organization. But he is the lawyer who has the purview or he controls the legal cases of the Guantanamo prisoners. You have to ask yourself, wait, go figure. This Zionist Jew has all of the cases for these guys being held in Guantanamo. And gee, what has happened for them in the courts in the last few years? Nothing.
That's why nothing seems to be going anywhere.
Right. You know, when you don't want cases to go anywhere, you give it to somebody like Michael Ratner. And then his sister Ellen Ratner runs like talk radio, a huge talk radio network. She has control of this so-called talk radio thing in the way that like Victor Thorne wanted to control the movement. The Ratner company in Cleveland, Four City Enterprises, the boss of that company is a guy named Sam Miller. Sam Miller is the father of his son is named, what is his name, Miller. He is the one who ran State Department Middle East policy for decades. And that guy is a key person in determining how the Middle East policy developed over the last 20, 30 years. I forgot his first name, but Miller is his last name. He's a long-faced guy. But Sam Miller, his father, ran the mayor of Cleveland. And you have to remember that two mysterious planes landed in Cleveland Airport on 9/11. One was identified as being Flight 93, and the other one was a flight that was with another company. But they landed.
Flight 93, when it landed there, was actually reported to have landed.
Yes.
And that report seemed to get squashed and jettisoned right away, didn't it?
Well, it was on the wire service. It was a 147-word story from the Associated Press, probably written in Cleveland, and it said that Flight 93 had landed, that United Airlines confirmed that was Flight 93, and that they also had a quote from the CEO of United Airlines and the mayor of Cleveland. And the mayor of Cleveland was a black man named White. I think his name was Michael White. And he is now safely retired in the middle of Ohio where he raises alpacas. And he doesn't want to talk about what he did on 9/11.
I wonder why.
This is very mysterious because they closed the entire airport, and the airport became a closed operation. And these two planes landed. I think one was Delta Flight 1987. I think it was Delta. And the other one was this UA Flight 93. And the passengers were offloaded from the airport, off the airplane, and taken into the NASA facility, the John Glenn Research Center there. And you have to ask yourself, why were these passengers from Flight 93 taken into a NASA center? Why weren't they simply taken to the airport and given a train ticket or a bus ticket?
Well, now here's the interesting thing, too. I mean, we're going to go off on a little tangent here, but NASA seems to have been a black hole for clandestine funding for a lot of criminal activities around the world. Instead of what the American public thought it was for, which was bona fide space research, instead it seems like a lot of this stuff was getting earmarked for criminal military activities around the world instead.
Right, and control of the inner space or the near space. I don't think that the NASA people ever made it to the moon either. And you know, if they're getting all this money, you know, they're talking now about going back to the moon. I think in 2020 or something like that. And yet, you have to ask yourself, if it was so easy to go there in 1969. And 1970, why is it that, you know, with today's technology, they can't go there? It doesn't make any sense at all.
No, it doesn't. But let's move to the most recent article you wrote, the criminal gang. This is the Likud criminal gang behind 9/11.
Right.
We know that the Likud has elements in America. You talked about the Cleveland elements. You can't talk about the supremacy group without talking about both the California element and the New York element. They have big and Miami.
Mm-hmm.
Cleveland, Miami, New York, and Los Angeles seem to be the main centers of their power base. And many of them, they have different roles. New York seems to be the place where they would, on 9/11, they short-sold a lot of the airline stocks. And no one seems to have done any investigating on who the short-selling was done by. And of course, you cannot place an order in a stock exchange anonymously. There are no anonymous orders placed in the stock market.
Well, most of that activity about the short buying of put options went through the Chicago Board of Options Exchange, the CBOE, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And there was a hint of an investigation, but as you said, the evidence was concealed. This is the key thing, is that such a plot like this, the number one thing they want to make sure is that they control the investigation, they control the evidence, and they control the prosecution of any crimes afterwards. And with Michael Chertoff, you know, running the Department of Justice at the time and the FBI, they were able to prevent any significant release of information of what happened. And that's what it's been all along. And when one of the things that occurred to me the other day is that the reason they did this in New York, the reason they had this horrible crime, 9/11, done in New York, is because New York City is the place where they control everything. They control the mayor, they control the governor, they control the Port Authority. And these are people that I've named in my articles about 9/11. I'm going to take my articles about 9/11 and put them into a book form. I hope to do that. But you know, if you look at, like, the person who ran the Port Authority, that was Louis Eisenberg.
Yep.
Louis Eisenberg is the person who sold, who oversaw the transaction in which the Twin Towers were sold to Larry Silverstein on July 26th. You know?
Now, did they have any control over Stewart? Because I know this. I know that Lowy and Silverstein were involved in the transfer of Stewart Air Force Base to private hands, the only private transfer in the country.
The thing is that this is the important thing, is that in 1990, this Ronald Lauder, who's got a school at Mossad University in Herzliya, Ronald Lauder, the son of Estee Lauder, in 1990, he became the chairman of the privatization board for the state of New York. And he encouraged the selling of airports and things like that. But in 2001, the only airport that had been, international airport that had been, had become privatized in New York was Stewart. The former Stewart Air Force Base. Stewart Airport became Stewart International Airport. And it was run by a British company based in Texas called Midland Express. I think it was called Midland Express. And that's the thing, is that Ronald Lauder was the key driving force behind the privatization of both the World Trade Center and Stewart Air Force.
And so he funneled these deals down to Silverstein and Frank Lowy.
He was the architect, and the way that he did this is that he hired the governor's wife, Pataki.
Yeah. Yeah.
Governor Pataki's wife was a paid consultant for Ronald Lauder to the tune of something like $150,000 a year for like a decade. So that way he was able to, you know, the governor's wife was making more than the governor was. And he was able to, you know, whenever you see these Zionists with Pataki, Pataki's always standing behind them, this red-faced Shabash boy, you know. He's a fool. He's a fool. And this argument that privatization is good for the people and the services that they provide, look at 9/11. And you ask yourself, did privatization do the people of New York City any good?
No.
And that's exactly what happened, you know. And this is a criminal gang behind this. And the thing is that what you have to ask, the question you have to ask is not just cui bono, or who benefited by 9/11, but you have to ask who else? Who else could have done this? Who else would have done this? And who else had a motivation strong enough? And every one of those questions comes back to the Zionist gang.
Yeah.
And then you have to look at, now we're 5 years down the road, and we can look, we look at the events in Afghanistan, particularly in Iraq. This war in Iraq, it's a complete, total war crime. You know, now that President Ford died, I heard on the radio today that President Ford had done an interview with one of these journalists in Simon Hersher, or Woodward, Bob Woodward, and in this interview had been embargoed because he said that the invasion of Iraq was a disaster, it was wrong, and that Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney were doing the wrong thing. Well, we all know that. I mean, you know, but it's important to understand that the invasion of Iraq was a criminal act.
Of course,
a lot of Americans don't appreciate that, but it's a criminal war. It's a war of aggression. These terms have meaning. It's a war of aggression. The French foreign minister wouldn't be pinned down on that, but that's exactly what it is. That makes these guys war criminals. That makes people like Dan Senior, working with the CPA, a war criminal.
I don't mean to shift gears here on you too much here, but we do have false investigators out here working against us, Christopher. Yeah. You know, when I look at the research early on of Carol Valentine, for example, or what Myron Fagan said, or so many quality people who put some effort into truth, and then I look around this movement today, and I look at the number of so-called investigators from the Jewish persuasion,
mm-hmm.
or I look at organizations like the one you worked for when it has mm-hmm. links to this guy Lane, and we looked into this guy Lane, and when I talked to Eustace Mullins about it, he said that this guy never would allow anything substantive to be done in the name of those publications that Cardo was fronting for. He said that they would either whitewash over them or try to stop them from getting their due. And you experienced that toward the end of your tenure there, that some of the more important stuff you were putting out would not get its airtime. It would, or if it did, it was poo-pooed, or it was pushed away, or it was edited out, or
That's right. The thing is that it's an article that I wrote about Ehud Olmert's ties to 9/11. That was the first article that was absolutely not printed. It was I submitted it in the end of May or beginning of June.
Yeah.
And it simply wasn't printed. Without any comments, without any, you know, my editor didn't say, Chris Petrick didn't say, no, this is not suitable or anything like that. It just didn't appear in the paper. Nobody told me. I only heard about it when Ellen Mariani called me from Denver and said, you know, your articles aren't in the paper. And then I checked, and when I got home and I looked, and I, sure enough, it wasn't. And that article hadn't been printed. And that was very important because, you see, I thought that our readers needed to know most Americans don't understand Zionism. They don't understand the history of Zionism. They don't understand the goals of Zionism. And they don't understand the key players.
Yep.
And so I was explaining to them about the dangers of Ehud Olmert, who he is, where he comes from, and his ideology. And I explained to them that in the region, the first 2 months of Ehud Olmert's reign were the most criminal, bloody first 2 months of any Israeli prime minister in history.
Yep.
And that this is they would have given the readers a clue as to what was going to happen in June and July. And we saw in July they had this terrible invasion, this provocation, false provocation, and invasion of Lebanon. But and then following that article that wasn't printed in American Free Press, I wrote a series of articles. I often write articles in series. And I wrote a series of articles about how the 9/11 movement is being controlled by big Zionists, like the Simon family of Indianapolis.
Yes.
They have big money, and they give money to small players in the 9/11 movement. So basically, the common theme that I've seen among these people is that they do not discuss the Israeli role in 9/11.
Well, we know the
900-pound gorilla in your front room.
Well, Deborah Simon gave Carl Schwartz a huge chunk of money.
$100,000.
Now, he seems to be going around the country peppering other people with that cash. But you also find Dylan Avery behind that Simon name. You find I don't know if Wing TV's people were Deborah Simon financed. But one has to wonder what we're up against here, because recently when David Duke went over to Iran, I had to say to myself, who in their right mind in Iran invited a white supremacist, declared white supremacist, to a conference? That you would have known in the advance that this guy was going to get negative press worldwide, and it's exactly what happened, and anybody with a brain would have known that. And I thought to myself, this was the dumbest damn move I ever saw. And then this guy comes back out, and of course he does his tap dance on CNN, and it makes everybody think that he's on the level. But I know darn well that, and Eustace Mullins said, this guy is available to anybody with a checkbook.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Eustace said.
The thing is like you mentioned this Deborah Simon. Well, Deborah Simon is married into the Simon family of Indianapolis. And the Simon family, they own and control most of the shopping malls and strip malls in the United States of America. When I say most, I mean most of the big ones. They own these malls. This is one of the big, big shopping mall families, and they're billionaires. And you have to ask yourself, well, why is this relative of the Simon family going around and financing people who are talking about 9/11 but only talking about certain things about 9/11, like Carl Schwartz? And you know, it's interesting. I know William Rodriguez. He's a 9/11 janitor who survived and was involved in the evacuation of the North Tower. I know him pretty well. I worked with him for about a year. I traveled around Europe with him. And you know, when we were in Europe, he used to talk about how he was being cultivated by the Democratic Party to be a governor. And Eric and I used to laugh about that and joke with him about that. But then when I invited him to come down to Venezuela with me to try and meet the government of Venezuela, he told me very clearly on the beach one day, he said that, you know, I can't talk about the Israeli role in 9/11, he told me. He didn't look happy about it. He looked pretty worried. He said, I can't talk about the Israeli role, he says, because of the Jewish relatives in the organization. And I thought to myself, well, what organization? You're in the Hispanic organization. You got this Hispanic group. And then I asked him, well, what about the Americans, you know? What about the Americans? How do they feel about, you know, all the blame being assigned to their government? And you can't talk about what you already know about Israeli involvement. And I put that in one of the articles when I talked about the 9/11 movement being co-opted or being controlled by the Zionists. And American Free Press didn't like that at all. They took it out, and they thought that I was being unfair to Mr. Rodriguez. And there were other things he said also. He told my wife very clearly that if Hillary Clinton wins, he said he'd be set for life. And, you know, I mean, I think that's something that the people that are involved in 9/11 research need to know. They need to know these things. And he's never challenged them. He's just, my paper, my former paper protected him on this, and I didn't understand that for the life of me.
Well, you know, Chris, you've been to my home here. I live modestly here. I'm not a guy with money in my pocket, and I certainly know it, you've never made money on doing these investigations. In fact, between the three of us, you, me, and Eric, we don't have a pile of change in our pocket.
No, there's no money in telling the truth in this day and age.
No, there isn't.
I can tell you that, as a matter of fact, no, you know, they broke my arm. I still can't straighten my right arm all the way. I'm pretty ticked off about that. They broke my arm, they tasered me, and they charged me with criminal offenses. And I just found out a guy who came to my last event. I had a recent event at the Schomburg Library where I presented my children's book, my ABC Zoo book. And it was interesting, some political people came to my event, four or five of them from the Chicago and the Wisconsin area. And we went to a restaurant nearby after the event. And we were being spied on. There was an agent at the bar that Deanne Burley and another guy noticed him, and they noticed that we were being spied on the entire time. We were being eavesdropped on. And you know, I can't believe it, but that's what this country has become. It's when all I do is work to tell the truth, to find the truth, to reveal the truth. And when you become an enemy of the state or when you're being spied on and being attacked and assaulted for that, you know, this country is occupied.
It is occupied, and we know that, you know that. And, you know, the listeners, actually, the traction we're getting these days from a very strong core. We've got many thousands of people that follow our research, and yours, mine, Eric's, and Condit, and Eustace, and some people who've got track records of being honest about these facts. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're under assault here. If you take a look at you know, I'm called everything in the book. I mean, I know you remember them. They saying my wife was black, which I don't care if she was or not, but it's not true. They come up with stuff that when they can't fight you on the facts, Christopher, they start using other means. And I have a sense, because I just received an email from one of your ex colleagues over at American Free Press, that they're going to do a big hit piece on you, myself, and Eric, coming up in this next week. Now, those have always failed miserably because they seem so disingenuous to the listener that they never go anywhere. So, I mean, if they want to put their toe in that water again, it's fine with me. Mm-hmm. However, that's only a symptom. You know, you see, these people aren't going to quit. They've got a big budget. Yeah. They've got a lot of, you know, ammunition. And here we are just trying to fight this fight with against tanks with wiffle bats, you know?
It's interesting you brought up this American Free Press connection again because, you know, Mark Lane, when I started American Free Press, I was told by a guy who worked there for decades, a guy who brought the newspaper up to a very high level of readership, something like 300,000 readers. He told me that, you know, that American Free Press, or the Spotlight, Liberty Lobby, had given Mark Lane $5 million in the past few years in these various lawsuits. And as I heard on your radio show, I think Eustace Mullins said that American Free Press or the Spotlight, the Liberty Lobby, that Mark Lane actually acquired those assets in 1994.
Yeah.
I heard that in 1994, Mark Lane took over, bankrupt organization, and so that would mean that since 1994, Mark Lane has actually been the proprietor, the owner,
yep.
the publisher.
Well, he's Jewish, of course,
not only that, he's from the left. He's a communist. He's a communist, a left wing Jew, and there's a photograph online of Mark Lane with Jane Fonda in 1970 sitting on an airplane at Cleveland Airport, of all places. You know, and it's like it's a small world.
Well,
and,
it is. Yeah.
You know, this American Free Press still has not reimbursed me for my traveling expenses going back from last July. You see, what I did when I came back to the United States in the spring of this year is I went on and visited key people that were in the 9/11 thing. I visited Professor Jones, Thomas Cahill at University of California, Davis, and Eric Cushman. And Ellen Mariani. These people are all in the Western states. And you know, what's very important is that putting the research of Stephen Jones together with the research of Thomas Cahill at UC Davis,
yep.
because that indicates that their research taken together proves that the fires that were raging beneath the rubble at the World Trade Center were at the boiling point of iron. There was boiling iron in the rubble of the World Trade Center. So, you know, the evidence is overwhelming. We don't have to get into exotic theories that there were no planes or that there was a micro nuke in the World Trade Center. The evidence is overwhelming that exotic explosives were used to cut those columns and bring down those towers. And the residue or the evidence of those exotic explosives like thermite existed in the rubble of the World Trade Center even as they pulled away the last bit of the rubble. They found molten metal at the base of the world of all three towers that fell. And I remember Eric Cushman, when I found out about this, he said, no, it can't be. It can't be. Because, you know, common sense and your scientific thinking would say it cannot be molten in a molten state for 5 weeks after underneath that in that oxygen-starved environment.
But it was creating its own oxygen through the chemical process that was used in the thermite compound.
But thermite doesn't need oxygen to react. Thermite can react in water. So they could be oxygen starved, you know, to the hilt. It doesn't matter.
That's right.
And, but that would also indicate that there was an incredible amount of explosives in these buildings that continue to react. This aluminothermic reaction would continue for so long. That means that they had so much redundancy into this because those buildings, of course, were redundant structures to start with. They were built in the late 60s, early 70s. They were built to last. And it's important to understand when people talk about these clouds of concrete that basically the only concrete in the buildings were in the floor pans. There was something like 4 inches of concrete. Each floor was 1 acre of concrete, 4 inches thick. But it was this lightweight concrete that sat in these floor pans. The rest of the buildings were basically drywall and steel. They were fundamentally steel structures, and they were super redundant steel structures. In order to bring them down, you had to have a heck of a lot of explosives in there.
Well, now here's what I this Stephen Jones issue over here with the liars for the scholars for lies up there and mm-hmm. Uncle Fester and the rest of these criminals over here.
Yeah, he broke away from them.
He did. Now I, you know, I sent him an email to see if Stephen wanted to work with some honest people for a change, and he might like that a lot better. I'm wondering if you've had any response from Mr. Jones.
Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question, because I was just thinking, I heard that that guy from North Carolina is going to run for president. I thought Stephen Jones for president would be a good thing. No, I contacted him about that. When I heard that he was pulling out of Scholars for Truth and that this Fetzer, Jim Fetzer in Minnesota was attacking him and basically, you know, adding insult to injury and saying all kinds of bad things about Professor Jones. And, you know, he had worked there. There was this Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds. They had already attacked Jones's research vigorously in some nonsense articles.
Yeah.
And so I asked him because I had warned Professor Jones when I went out there in March of last year. I warned him about hooking up with people he didn't really know And I told him that the 9/11 movement is crawling with agents. And these are agents who will pretend to be your friend, pretend to be researchers, give you some good information, help you out, and then they'll turn around and stab you in the back. And I've seen it so many times.
I warned him about this.
I warned him about it. And son of a gun, that's exactly what happened.
I warned him about it, turned on him. Well, I talked to him after that. When Eric and I did that piece on that young man that was murdered, and we implied that there's more to that, that it was murder, and we implied that there was a connection to that group. And he wrote me back saying, you know, that's a very powerful accusation, beyond the pale, he wrote. And so I called Stephen, and I said, look, you know, there is a lot of evidence that these people are not on the level. And I talked to him about it, and, you know, I was hoping at the time that he would see his way clear to maybe working a little closer with us. He doesn't have to join any group. There's nothing to join here. It's just basically we're making an effort toward the evidence. However, you know, I'm still hoping that, and here's a standing invitation for Professor Jones. We loved your original work. We want to be a place where you could get yourself heard. I mean, you don't have to join anything over here, Stephen. It's an open forum for the truth on the French Connection, and you know, you've got a permanent place here on our pages, because we've gotten more and more traffic every day, Christopher. And I tell you something, you know, we don't compromise. Eric and I put the stuff out as we find it. Now, we're not always spot on, but boy, I'll tell you something, we're usually pretty close.
You know what's interesting about Professor Jones is that he was set up on an NPR radio show in Salt Lake City. He was set up on, I think it was September 6th this year, the day that classes started at BYU, where he's been a professor for 21 years, teaching. And then, you know, they got him on thin ice. They wanted him to make a comment about who he thought was really behind this. They didn't really want to talk about his science, because his science is something they can't attack him on.
Yeah.
So they got him to say something about, and he said something about the international banking cartel. And he cited, that this information or this theory came from Webster Tarpley, another guy I wouldn't trust too much.
Yeah.
And he said, well, this is what Webster Tarpley, a fellow in the 9/11 Scholars for Truth, etc., had said. And then they took that, these Jewish fellows that came on afterwards, two Jewish professors, one from Northwestern, one from the University of Utah, they came on and they basically crucified Professor Jones as being an anti-Semite because he had used the word international banking cartel, you know, meaning the Rothschilds and this and that. But I mean, this is the thing. This international banking cartel or this private equity firms. I mean, this is the only growth industry in the country today. I was just hearing on the radio this morning is that these private banks, these private investment firms like Carlyle Group and like Blackstone, they have more money than they know where to put. They can't find enough businesses to buy anymore. And because they buy them and they sell them a few years later. And this is amazing. See, when the American people don't have medical care, the American people don't have food to eat, the American people can't afford to heat their houses, they can't afford to go to the doctors or the dentist, and then there's these private equity firms that have oodles of cash, they don't know where to put it.
Yeah.
This country has reached the point where we have only the super rich and the working poor.
It's miserable.
And then they have these illegal wars, and they promote these illegal wars, and you know what's important to understand here is that when we had Dan Senior, you know, advising Jerry Bremer, and they were running the country of Iraq for a year and a half, they didn't measure any of the oil that was being loaded onto tankers in Basra.
And weren't their estimates as high as 3 billion missing? As high as?
Yes, it's billions and billions and billions of dollars went missing. And you see, this is the thing, is that this country, this United States, where we cannot, you're in France, here we can't even get a train. We don't have decent trains at all that can take you from point A to point B, you see? And George Bush, in the last budget, he zero-lined Amtrak. He didn't want to give any money at all to the passenger rail service in this country. Yet they spend more money in 3 days in Iraq than they would spend in running the trains in this country for a year. And nobody squawks about that.
Well, and not only that, it's costing us our young men. They're dying. They're being poisoned. They're being killed off. And I don't think that that's not intentional. I think that they've sent our young men over there to die. And I think they want a fractured military that, when it returns home, can't fight back against their criminal intent.
You know, the disaster of Iraq is not understood in this country. That, you know, a huge percentage of the population has left the country. And they've used all this depleted uranium. They've contaminated the environment. The water's contaminated. The people, the services, the basic fundamental services of life, electricity and water and security, is worse now than it was under Saddam Hussein.
Much worse.
They intend to hang in the next month.
Much worse.
And this is after this huge investment of $300 billion or $500 billion, however much money that we've spent. It's like $500 billion. We spent already on these two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what's the point? They're both illegal. And
well,
that's
we're living
the
thing,
you have to understand that it's a criminal gang behind the attacks on 9/11 and behind the wars. There's a reason why they're not measuring the amount of oil they're taking out of Iraq. Because they're stealing it. Because they're criminals from the A to Z.
You want to hear this one, Christopher. We're running a deficit, a negative balance a government balance right now for this year of $8 trillion is where it's gone up to. And did you know that this is the biggest surplus the Israelis have ever reported this year?
Mm-hmm. I'm not at all surprised.
Well, it's a fact, and they just reported their largest fiscal surplus in their history when America has just reported its largest deficit in world history of any country of all time, Rome all the way up to the present.
Because 9/11 was the opening salvo on a war against the United States, and this war against the American people, against the American way of life, you know, the Patriot Act, which was a huge body blow to our liberties and our republic, was written by Michael Chertoff and his Vietnamese cohort at the Department of Justice, and it was ready for 9/11. All of this was prepared well in advance, and that's why, you know, you don't have to be a genius to look at all of this evidence that we're talking about, all of these apparent coincidences, how Ehud Olmert, the current Prime Minister of Israel, is a co-defendant of the guy who controlled passenger security at Boston's airport on 9/11. Is that a coincidence? And then that the FBI doesn't pull these people in, and that Congress gives them carte blanche or exonerates them?
Well, that's
how can you exonerate the people?
America.
Beg your pardon?
That's the main criminal police force of the United States, the FBI.
Right, right. And you know, the evidence is clear that the FBI has been the obfuscator, the one that has concealed evidence rather than revealed evidence.
Well, then, you know,
they've been involved. They were involved in the death of Senator Wellstone.
That's right.
The only senator that had the guts to stand up to the illegal war on terror, and they had to remove him. And now we have this Congress. I mean, you know, if Paul Wellstone had not been killed on that day up in Minnesota, then he would have been a champion for the truth. He would have protested this Patriot Act. He would have protested the war against Iraq and Afghanistan. And now it's like we're a country with no opposition. Even when we had an election in 2004, there was no opposition to the war.
That's right. And there isn't going to be, because we know. And I give my listeners a little tidbit here. You know, remember we've talked about this with Eric and you. They use these honey traps to get politicians, you know, blackmailed or held over, extorted or whatever. I was looking the other day, just by accident, at who Sylvester Stallone's mother is. Her name is Jacqueline Lubavitch. And Jacqueline Lubavitch is a big strip club owner in the Northeast. And she owns the Pussycat Lounge, I think, and several others. Providence, Rhode Island, Hartford, Connecticut, I think. We got one up in Boston. Each one of these has a very high-end VIP room, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Not very different than the Runway 69 VIP room of Mr. Silverstein and others.
Or the Gold Club of Atlanta.
Well, yeah, and here...
The King of Sweden. The King of Sweden visited that Jewish strip club down in Atlanta.
There you go.
So they get these very high-ranking people, you know, nobility. They get kings and queens and congressmen and senators. And like you said, they get them in some situation where they get the evidence on them, and they're blackmailable for life.
That's right.
This is the oldest trick in the book.
Well, it is the oldest trick, and here you can take a look at you know, these trips to Thailand, and if you take a look at the ownership behind it, you'll find a Zionist Jew behind it. If you take a look at you know, the child slavery, you'll look at the porn industry, you look at the sex slavery, all of this stuff is going back to them, and they use it as a way of no, they've got the mailing list. They know what computers log on to this nonsense. They can do a little investigation and find out exactly who's doing what where. And that's how you get people shut up. I mean, if you're a person with money and you've dallied in a couple of bizarre, you know, dalliances, of course, and you're in Hollywood or you're in politics or something, if you're in low-level politics, if you get caught doing something like that, you're slated to go higher. They're not going to get rid of you. You're going to be senator next, you know.
Right.
But if you're a Hollywood star, play the game. We'll give you a couple of roles in some lousy movies, give you some paychecks, make you, you know. And you'll end up like Tom Cruise or this dirtbag or others like this.
Well, you promote the misfits and you promote the criminals. You promote the criminal class is being promoted, and that's how they're doing with voting machines in this country. So then you wind up with a real bona fide crimocracy where
that's
the criminals
right.
are running the government, which is
a
what we have here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's a crimocracy, and that's why these huge crimes like the. The Estonia catastrophe in 1994, where 852 people died. It's not being investigated, and they still control the government in Sweden and the government in Estonia, so the truth doesn't come out. And that happened 12 years ago. And you see, that's where I first got involved, when I first saw that a government will tolerate the mass murder of its own civilians and cover it up. And so that when 9/11 happened, and I saw the same thing happening here, when I saw the same kind of final reports coming out that don't even discuss the evidence, when I saw the same kind of obfuscation and stealing of evidence, then I wasn't surprised. It happens here.
Well, we live in a Machiavellian world where you know, up is down and left is right, where any murder on their side is justified in their own minds, and there's no morality left. And but they've also poisoned the ability of the public to understand these crimes through poor education, destruction of our education. They want a worker bee class that doesn't think, Christopher.
But they control the media, and because they control the media, you look, Daryl. They control interpretation of history. When I was at the University of California, they had a class at the end of my studies of history called Interpretation of History, and I wondered, what is that all about? Now I understand. They want to interpret the history of the Second World War, and they interpret that history through the media and give it to the average person. So they read about, they hear about the Holocaust, and they have great sympathy and empathy for the Jewish people. Then you have to ask yourself, well, why do the Jews need all this sympathy? Why have they created this whole big myth, this whole big thing about the Holocaust? You have to say to yourself, well, if they're creating this huge shield, there must be something they're hiding behind.
Living in France, I don't investigate that subject because they will come over to my door, kick it in, and then drag me off to jail. And so I rather than having my meals on metal plates, I try to leave that to other people who are not threatened with prison.
Well, what I'm saying is that they've done the interpretation of 9/11 in the same way. 9/11 has been interpreted not by a Blue Ribbon Investigation panel, not by the FBI presenting the evidence. It has been interpreted for the American people through the media by repeating certain myths about the 19 Arabs with box cutters, by presenting a Hollywood version, if you will. I mean, three movies came out last year, all Hollywood, all produced by Zionists, all presenting the official version of 9/11. They figured that 5 years after the event, they could finally come out with movies about it, you know, so they came out with these movies. And these movies present the very flawed view that 9/11 was what they said it was, et cetera.
Well, we battle here, you and I and Eric and many others. There, you know, I want to give the due to the listenership here because I'll tell you something. We've got a very intelligent group working with us. We're small, but we're powerful. We're powerful because the people that do listen, that aren't dumbed down, are opinion shapers in this world, Christopher. We've got 40% of our listenership in Europe and 60% in North America and smatterings of the rest of the world. The fact of the matter is that this is a force of people because we are well informed and we are opinion shapers. And I see a movement here, starting to, because these people can't see 10,000, 15,000 people with the truth can really knock the tar out of a multi-billion-dollar effort against the truth.
Right. And the thing is also is that this group of people, this this Zionist agenda that we're talking about, 9/11 and the war in Iraq and everything, they always go too far. They don't have the common sense, and if they're going to push, they don't do things in half measures. They have an agenda. They want to control the Middle East. They want to take out Iran. They want to do regime change here and there and whatnot. And so the people who are fighting these wars, and the people who are lives are being ruined, are a huge force, and the force of truth is larger than anyone. And it's like, you know, these people who are trying to stop us, who are trying to obscure the truth, who are trying to conceal the truth about 9/11, I compare them to a small animal on a railroad track facing an oncoming freight train. The freight train of truth and of the people in this world who want the truth is much larger than them.
That's right. And we don't it's not a financial control either, because people understand that we're descending into tyranny in many parts of the world, including here in Europe. Everybody's, you know, getting a jackboot police department in France as well. And I can tell you honestly, 8-10 years ago in this country, the police were approachable. Today, they snarl at you when you go up to them. There has been a sea change in the way that the police deal with their public here in this country. And, of course, you know, if you go into America, last time I was in New York, I asked for a policeman for something, and boy, I thought I was going to have my head torn off.
Well, I would say the New York cops are about the best in this country, too, because I've met the New York cops. I think they're pretty good. But I can tell you that the police here, what we found out is that the police here, the actual policeman of the team of three who attacked me, who tasered me when I was already down on the ground, he had worked with the Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah.
And that every police force in this country has a liaison with the Department of Homeland Security. And this is a very, very frightening development, because this means that the local police are no longer, solely being run as a local unit.
And they're not serving the public anymore.
Right. They're being correspondent. And when I went to court, I've been to court three times on this thing because I keep getting continuances and whatnot. When I went last time, this same group of police officers, the three that attacked me and a couple others were there, and they were in the court, and you know what they were doing as they came in? They were giving each other high fives. They were giving high fives in a court of justice, because they know that they're invulnerable. They know that the judge will not rule against them. They know that they're like untouchable. And I can tell you, this is very disconcerting to see that kind of thing in a court today.
Well, what's happening with that case? Is it going to get?
Yeah, I have to go back on the end of January, January 31st. I've got to go back, and my lawyer, I hope, will. It's been through continuances and whatnot. I hope that now it's going to. I hope to be acquitted. Many people have said, why don't you get the lawyer to have a motion to dismiss, to get rid of it, because. But he's a former prosecutor. He seems to think that that's not the thing to do. He doesn't really have a lot to say to me. He doesn't do a lot of communication with me. It's kind of like, you see, it's not justice in this country. I see it's not justice. It's process. It's all process.
Yeah.
The lawyers talk to each other. The different sides talk to each other. Deals are made. Deals are struck. And it's just like the people in 9/11. My case is minor compared to theirs. Ellen Mariani lost her husband. She's been waiting for 5 years to get her case heard. It will never be heard. I'm sorry to say that none of the 9/11 relatives will ever have their day in court.
Well, whenever you want 20,000 phone calls to go someplace, just give me the phone number and I'll put it out there. How's that?
Thank you very much. You were a great help.
Hey, you know, this show, we bounced along a lot of information today, and of course every visit with you, Christopher, is that way. We've had many. I want to thank you for coming on the French Connection today, and I'll tell you something. You know, you're a big part of what we do. You'll always have a home here, and I hope actually we can enlist the quality research of some other quality human beings. So on your travels, if you do speak to Stephen or others, tell them that they've got a place to put their efforts if they'd like.
Well, you're a great radio host, and I really appreciate being on your show. And give the best Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to Pascal and yourself.
I will. Thank you, Chris.
From our family. Thank you very much.
All right, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, Christopher Bolin, and, of course, you know, Christopher's family, I wish them all the finest for this this new year. And, you know, the 2007 is going to be a pivotal year for each and every one of us. So please be aware, ladies and gentlemen, that the French Connection has got a lot more research to do, and we have a lot more doors to open for you. But until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith telling you to be well. Bye-bye now.